You're good?
All right. Good morning, everybody. Sorry about the technical problems. I'm not sure what the deal was. Did everything the same way we always do. So we'll just record this and then upload this after the fact, okay? So we'll at least get it recorded and then be able to go on from there. All right, so you should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 140, the Bishop's Bible Old Testament. Now, you're going to want to have your Bible with you here because after a while here, we're going to be making some comparisons. But let's get into this since we are kind of running behind now by a few minutes. So, introduction. Last week in lesson 139, we looked at the process used by Archbishop Parker to produce the Bishop's Bible. Now, I am going to try here quick, just on my page, to go live using Facebook. So that we at least can do that. And we will worry about other things later. Okay, so introduction. Last week in lesson 139, we looked at the process used by Archbishop Parker to produce the Bishop's Bible. Today in lesson 140, we want to consider the Old Testament text found in the Bishop's Bible. So we're going to be looking specifically at the Old Testament text that the Bishop has. So today in lesson 140, as I said, we want to consider the Old Testament text. So let's look at the first point, which is basically the main point. Last week in lesson 139, we observed that Archbishop Parker, appropriately titled Bishop's Bible, was a revision of Cranmer's 1540 edition of the Great Bible. Blackford Condit stated the following regarding the matter in his 1882 publication, The History of the English Bible. He said, quote, Cranmer's Bible, 1540, was chosen as the basis of the revision. While it was the accepted version of the English Church, yet it was so inferior to the Geneva Bible that it was unacceptable to many who were prominent in the Episcopal Party. Complaints were made even before the issue of the Geneva Bible against Cranmer's version, although at the same time it was admitted that as a version it was nearer the Hebrew than the translation ascribed to Jerome. Parker's first rule for guidance of the revisers was, quote, to follow the common English translation used in the churches, which would have been the Great Bible. So, again, we had a whole lesson last Sunday talking about the process and the project that was embarked on here by Archbishop Parker. Multiple sources report that the Bishop's Old Testament exhibits a strong propensity towards following this rule when compared to the New Testament. For example, Condon states, quote, this rule was especially carried out in the revising of the Old Testament. So let me just stop there and say, so this first rule, to follow the common English translation used in the churches, which would have been the 1540 Great Bible, this rule seems to have been followed more closely with the Old Testament than with the New Testament as we look at the Bishop's Bible. And again, this image here, this is the title page. I pulled a 1568 Bishop's Bible off of the internet. I downloaded it from archive.org as a PDF. And this is the title page of it. And that's Queen Elizabeth there as a central figure image on the page. We'll say more about this actually when we talk about the contents of the Bishop's Bible. But when it comes to the Old Testament, which is what we want to focus our attention on this morning, it appears that there was more adherence to this rule to follow the Great Bible in the Old Testament than there was possibly with the New Testament. Jared Hammond states the following regarding the matter in his The Making of the English Bible. He says, quote, the most important instruction was the first, to the effect that the translator should follow the common English translation used in the churches. In other words, the Great Bible, and not to recede from it, but where it varieth manifestly from the Hebrew or Greek original. Manifestly is obviously the let out clause here, and most were happy to take it. It is doubtful, anyway, if any of Parker's team of bishops had the ability to make such a judgment, and for the most part, they happily reprinted the Great Bible text with, now and then, a revision introduced from the Geneva Bible. So what Hammond is saying there is, by and large, what they did, especially in the Old Testament, is they just reproduced the text of the Great Bible from 1540 with the occasional revision. When they revise it, they often provide the Geneva reading as the revised reading. So again, why are they doing this Bible in the first place? They're doing this Bible because they think they need a competitor to the Geneva Bible. Yet as they are going about the process of revising the Great Bible, they are often, when they alter the text of the Great Bible, they are altering it and providing the reading provided by the Geneva Bible. So it's sort of one of those things that is, you sort of ask yourself, well, why bother going through the process then if that's all you're going to do? Well, again, this is all political, right? They don't like the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible marginal notes are heavily Calvinistic, like we've seen in previous lessons. And these guys, in these high church bishops of the Anglican Church, they don't like all of this. So they're going to go about now revising the Great Bible. Hammond goes on to illustrate this point using Jeremiah 6 as an example. Take it as an example, the 30 verses of Jeremiah 6, where there are only 7 differences between the text of the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible, and this despite the fact that the Geneva Bible had altered every other phrase. The changes the bishops makes are these. Okay, so I provided the table there for you that Hammond has. So let's just go grab Jeremiah 6 in your Bible. Go grab Jeremiah 6. And we could kind of make some comparisons here, okay? Now, as you look at the table there, and I will provide this here for the, hopefully the benefit of the camera. I'm not sure how clear it'll show up, but we'll give it a whirl. We're talking about this table. Whoops. That's the wrong notes. We need the notes from Sunday school, not the notes from church service. So for those of you that are watching online, we're talking about these notes here on page 2. So this table right here. Now, first thing I want to point out about this, notice there are only what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 verses here that are listed in the table. So what does that mean? That means that for all the rest of these, if you look at Jeremiah 6, I got to stop talking and actually get there. If you look at Jeremiah 6, how many verses are there in Jeremiah 6? 30. There's 30 verses, okay? So the first thing you need to observe then in looking at the table there on page 2 is only in these 6 verses did the Bishop's Bible change the text of the Great Bible. So for all 30 of these verses, they're only changing how many verses? 6 verses. In the remaining, what, 24 verses, the Bishop's reads exactly the same as what?
The Great Bible.
Okay, so understand, that's why we only have here 6 verses, because these are the only 6 verses where they made a change. All right, the remaining 24 that aren't listed in the table for Jeremiah 6 read identical in the bishops as they did where? In the Great Bible. Okay, so let's look at a few of these. Verse 3. The great head, everyone shall feed them that are under his hand. The bishops changed that in verse 3 to everyone shall feed in his place. So, King James, the shepherds with their flocks shall come unto her. They shall pitch their tents against her round about, and they shall feed everyone in his what? Place. Okay? So which, is that the same reading there in the King James that the bishops had in verse 3? Alright? So this is one of the instances where the bishops' translators changed the Great Bible text. And then does the bishops' text end up in the King James?
Yeah.
Does everybody follow that? Did I say that wrong?
Well, they didn't put every one. Well, I guess it's switched around.
Yeah, they put shell feed in front of everyone.
Yeah. So it's not identical then. There's a slight change. Okay, let's go to verse 12. So the great head, when I stretch out mine hand, in verse 12, the bishops says, for I will stretch out mine hand. The King James in verse 12 says, therefore I am full of fury, I am full of the fury of the Lord, I am weary with holding in, I will pour it out upon the children abroad and upon every assembly. Jeremiah. I'm in the wrong verse, aren't I? Sorry.
The second half of 12.
The second half of verse 12. For I will stretch out for I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. The bishop said, for I will stretch out mine what? Hand. What's the difference? The great had when I. The bishops had what?
For
I will stretch out my hand. This says when I stretch out mine hand. So, I mean, that's not necessarily a very great difference there, but you see the level here of conformity that the bishops has with the great Bible here, right? So in all 30 of these verses, these are the only six changes that the only six verses that are changed. Look at verse 20. The great Bible has or had your burnt offerings. The bishops change that to your whole burnt offerings. And the King James says what?
Your burnt
offerings. So it leaves out what?
Whole.
Okay? Look at verse 21. The great Bible had, and therefore shall fall from among them. And the bishop says, and there shall fall at them. And what's the King James have there, since you guys are ahead of me on this?
Shall fall upon them.
Shall fall upon them, yes. So again, is there a difference? Verse 24, the great Bible had the cry of them have we heard. The bishops had the fame of them have we heard. And the King James had what in verse 24?
We have heard the fame
thereof. Okay, now, I don't want you to get confused here. In Jeremiah 6, there are 30 verses, right? Only six of them have any kind of change between the bishops and the great Bible. In the remaining 24 verses, the bishop's Bible reproduces exactly word for word verbatim the text of the great Bible as it moves that text forward in 1568. Is everybody following that? So let's look at the note then underneath this on page 2. Let's look at the note underneath this on page 2. Of the changes, those from verses 3 and 12, the first in verse 21, so I might have accidentally left something out there, I need to check that, are taken directly from the Geneva Bible. So, of the changes that are made, so there's six changes made here, right? At least that I have up here, I might have accidentally left out another one. The one made in verse 3, the one made in verse 12, and one of the ones made in verse 21 are taken directly from the Geneva Bible. And in verse 24, fame, the word fame comes from Geneva's, we have heard their fame. So only the word whole in verse 20 and there and at in verse 21 are original Bishop's Bible revisions. So is the Bishop's Bible basically, especially in the Old Testament, are they basically following that first rule to reproduce the great Bible? Unless there's a reason to change it. And even in the places where they are altering the Great Bible, they are very often altering it in accordance with the Geneva Bible. Now, I know that can get a little bit confusing there. Does anybody have any questions?
Is Haman saying that this example serves as normal for the rest of the Old Testament?
So he's going to give some more examples, but essentially he's saying... And it also depends on what part of the Old Testament you're looking at, because we saw last week that the Old Testament was divided up into various sections and given to different folks who were responsible for it. But he is using this to illustrate what he thinks is the general sense of the situation through all the Old Testament, and he's going to give some more examples here. Any other questions? Hammond goes on to excoriate Parker's bishops in terms of their work on the Old Testament. In a lengthy section, Hammond uses their work in the Psalms as a case in point. So, Nate, he gives the Jeremiah text there as emblematic of their work in the prophetic section, and then he deals with the poetry section or the wisdom literature here in this part. Yes?
The reason you don't have it is because he's on camera and not moving. You have five people waiting for the class.
Well, who's waiting?
I don't know. Sylvia just called me and said,
I cannot get the streaming camera to work this morning, so I am making a recording that I will upload later. So Hammond goes on to excoriate Parker's bishops in terms of their work on the Old Testament in a lengthy section. Hammond uses their work in the Psalms as a case in point. So this is a long quote that we're going to be working our way through here, okay? Sometimes the translator copied as much or more from the Geneva Bible as from the Great Bible. So this is in the Psalms now. But in only a few books of the Old Testament is there any recognizably original work. This laziness might not seem such a bad thing, however, if we look at the part of the Bible where one of Parker's team had labored to produce an original translation. Better a sleeping bishop than an active one. The book in question is the Psalms, where the translator achieved some bizarre renderings, many of them apparently inspired by his particular attitudes towards the original and towards English style. In the opening verse of Psalm 2, the Hebrew splits into two short parallelistic lines. So find Psalm 2 in your Bible. Find Psalm 2 in your King James Bible. So you can have that and compare what's going on here. But so here are the lines, okay? This would be an overly literal rendering, okay? Why they rage nations and the people they imagine vanity. Okay? Coverdale translated it like this in the Great Bible, not unattractive, but characteristically windy. So this is what Coverdale had in the Great Bible. Why do the heathen grudge together, and why do the people imagine a vain thing? So that's what the Great Bible had. That second sentence, let me read it again. Why do the heathen grudge together, and why do the people imagine a vain thing? Geneva tightened this up, making its rendering close to the 3-3 stress balance of the Hebrew. So this is what the Geneva had. Why do the heathen rage and the people murmur in vain? So that's what the Geneva had. The bishop's translator works on the principle of the more words the better, adding even to Coverdale's rendering. So this is what the bishop said. Why do the heathen so furiously rage together, and why do the people imagine a vain thing? Now, what does your King James have in that verse?
Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing?
So it's much more simplistic and compact and less wordy than what Coverdale had or even what the bishop's rendering has. More striking is his treatment of Psalm 23. In the Great Bible, rendering the simplicity of the original had tended to get lost, especially in the second verse. So if you go to Psalm 23, everyone probably can quote this pretty much. Here's what the Great Bible had there. The Lord is my shepherd, therefore can I lack nothing. He shall feed me in a green pasture and leadeth me forth besides the waters of comfort. The Geneva Bible had shortened this almost to the version made famous by the Authorized Version's rendering. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me rest in green pasture and leadeth me by the still waters. Okay? But when we turn to the bishop's Bible, we find a profusion of unnecessary words. Here's what they had. God is my shepherd, therefore I can lack nothing. He will cause me to repose myself in a pasture full of grass, and will lead me unto calm waters. Now what do you have in your King James Bible? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside what?
Still waters.
You see how short and compact that is compared to what the bishops had? The bishop's talking about reposing myself in a pasture full of grass. Okay? Words and more words is the great belief of this translator, born no doubt out of his belief in what constitutes good English style. In Psalm 10:8, he inherited these two renderings, an unusually compact one from the Great Bible, slightly amplified in the Geneva Bible. So the Great Bible had, so this would be in Psalm 10, so Psalm 10 verse 8. The Great Bible had, he sitteth lurking in the streets, and privily doth he murder the innocent, his eyes are set against the poor. The Geneva Bible had, he lieth in wait in the villages, in the secret places doth he murder the innocent, his eyes are bent against the poor. The bishop's translator happily continued the process of padding it out, or adding more what? More words. He sitteth lurking in thievish corners of the streets, and privily in lurking dens he doth murder the innocent. He eyeth diligently him that is weak. So what's King James have in that verse?
He sitteth in the lurking places of the villages, in the secret places doth he murder the innocent. His eyes are privily set against the poor.
So, yeah, I mean, if you compare that with what the King James had, the word thievish isn't there. There's a lot more words in the bishop's rendering than in any of those other ones. Okay? This is continued in the next verse, where he again inherited reasonably controlled renderings. Great Bible rendering had. For he lieth in wait secretly, even as a lion lurketh he in his den, that he may ravage the poor. He doth ravage the poor when he getteth him into his net. The Geneva had, he lieth in wait secretly, even as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait to spoil the poor. He doth spoil the poor when he draweth him into his net. Here's the bishop's. He lieth in wait lurking as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait lurking that he may violently carry away the afflicted. He doth carry away violently the afflicted, inhaling him into his net. So is there a lot of extra words there that are absolutely redundant that don't need to be there? Okay, so the King James has, so this would be chapter 10, verse 11, right? 10, sorry. Verse 10 or 9? It's verse 9, I believe. He lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. All right? So in that verse, does the King James have more in common with the bishops or more in common with the Geneva? I would say it has more in common with the Geneva. It's more succinct, okay? So, Hammond also cites how the bishop's translators, handled the names of God in the Old Testament as further example of the oddities found in the bishop's Bible. Quote, a greater source for the strangeness of this translator's renderings, and one which throws light upon the complete lack of any editorial policy for the bishop's Bible, was his peculiar reliance upon his own notions of what the Hebrew meant. Rather than the consensus of earlier translators, this is most apparent in his translation of the names of God. Tradition had long held that Yahweh should be translated as Lord. Tyndale's Jehovah was only for the few contexts where God was naming himself. Okay? And Elohim as God. Dominus or Decius in Latin versions. The bishop's translator was probably the only one who ever disagreed with this, and he reverses these terms throughout the Psalms. So, starting with Tyndale and coming all the way through, was there a particular way the names of God were handled in the Old Testament? All right, and it was that way. Everybody had done it that way, except whoever was responsible for this, for the portion of the Psalms, and they basically flip it and do it totally opposite and different than everyone had done it before them. Okay, so the bishop's translator was probably the only one who disagreed with this, and he reverses these terms throughout the Psalms. Although the rest of the Bible kept the traditional forms. So everywhere else in the bishop's Old Testament do they do it the way that Tyndale and Coverdale and everybody else and before them had done it. But then when you come to the Psalms, whoever the translator was that was responsible for this passage, does he flip it even though the whole rest of the Old Testament followed the way it was before? So, hence, we get God is my shepherd at the opening of Psalm 23. In the opening of Psalm 82, however, he meets a complication which defeats him, where the Hebrew uses Elohim twice, as well as a third name of God, El. Both of these names have alternative translations to God. Elohim is the plural form and can therefore be taken to mean gods. And there is also a tradition which makes it mean in some other places judges, as in Exodus chapter 21, verse 6, where Tyndall had added the simple explanatory note, gods are the judges which are in God's stead. El also means mighty one. The Hebrew of this verse reads, Elohim stands in the assembly of El, in the midst of Elohim he judges. He cites two Latin examples, which I'm not going to give you because they're in Latin, you can't read them. And three English translations give three further possibilities. Coverdale had, God standeth in the congregation of the gods and is a judge among the judges. The Great Bible had, God standeth in the congregation of princes, he is a judge among gods. Geneva Bible had, God standeth in the assembly of gods, he judgeth among gods. In the face of this diversity, the bishop's Bible translator was justified in making his own interpretation, but it stands as the most curious of all in its insistence that all three words should be taken to mean the same thing. God standeth in the congregation of God, he judges in the midst of God. Okay, now what verse was that again?
Psalm 82:1. Yep.
What's King James have there? Somebody that has it already?
God standeth in the congregation of the mighty, he judgeth among the gods.
So if you look at those, can you read it one more time, please?
God standeth in the congregation of the mighty, he judgeth among the gods.
So the King James is slightly different even yet, but his point, what Hammond's point is here, is that the translator here, he uses the same word every time, right? So it says, God standeth in the congregation of God, he judges in the midst of God. That doesn't really make a lot of sense at all.
Was he maybe trying to just show that God had no equal? Like there were the other translations almost appear like there's an assembly of gods, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me either.
What he's I think that's what he's trying to do, but it ends up in my mind sort of, it makes less sense to read it this way than it does the other way. I think the point is, do the Gentiles have a lot of gods and goddesses out there?
Yeah.
All right. God standeth. Read it, the King James one again there, Amy, if you would.
God standeth in the congregation of the mighty, he judgeth among the gods.
So the central point of the verse is that God is, you know, superior, that Jehovah Elohim is superior over, you know, any other so-called God that's out there. Most ironic is that in this place in the Psalms, where the traditional ascriptions of God to Elohim is found, but then Lord would have read even stranger in this context. So Hammond's point is that he flips all this stuff. So whoever the translator is that's responsible for the Psalms portion of the bishop's Bible, is he doing all kinds of weird stuff? He's adding all kinds of unnecessary words, and he's breaking with the way that these words had traditionally been handled. Okay, so after his analysis of the bishop's text, particularly in the book of Psalms as cited above, Hammond pulls no punches in clearly stating his feelings regarding the bishop's Bible. He says, quote, "For the most part, the bishop's Bible is either a lazy and ill-informed collation of what had gone before, or in its original parts, the work is of third-rate scholars and second-rate writers. It in no way could hold comparison with the Geneva Bible." So, is the Geneva Bible hands down going to be better? Is it hands down better than what these guys put together?
Yeah.
It seems that way, okay? Of all the sources I consulted in preparation for this lesson, were in general agreement with the following statement from the pen of J.I. Mombert in English versions of the Bible. Quote, "In the Old Testament of the Great Bible, was not only the basis of the bishop's Bible, but to a considerable extent remained unchanged." So where they change it, they either give you the Geneva or they give you something original that didn't make it better, that didn't improve it necessarily. Blackford Conant concurs with Mombert and offers the following extract from Genesis 45 as evidence on pages 278 and 279 of his book, The History of the English Bible. So I have screenshot this. Rather than sitting here to type all this out, I took a screenshot of these pages, and that's what I've included here. So let's look at a few of these. So you might want to find Genesis 45 in your Bible, so you can kind of follow along there too, because that might be helpful to you. Genesis 45. Okay. So what we're looking at here is this is Mombert and his comments on the situation here as it relates to the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible. Verse 1. Joseph could no longer refrain before all that stood by him. Wherefore he cried, cause every man to avoid. Cramer's Bible reads, bring forth all the men from me. King James. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all of them and stood by him, and he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. So the point here is there a change here in the Bishop's Bible from the Great Bible? Look at number 2. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. Cramer's Bible reads, so that the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. So is there a lot of change there? The only difference is basically the word "and." It's not very different. Verse 4. So again, these are only the changes. Let me be clear. These are only the changes that are made between the bishops and the Great Bible. Look at verse 4. Joseph said unto his brethren, "Come near to me, I pray you." These words are not in Cranmer's Bible. So the words "I pray you" are not in the 1540 Great Bible. They are added by the bishop's translators. Are they in the King James?
Yes.
They are in the King James. Verse 5. Now therefore be not grieved herewith, for God did send me before you to preserve life. Cramer's Bible has therewith, so they changed therewith to herewith, and instead of preserve life, they had save life. What did the King James have?
Preserve.
The King James had what?
Preserve life.
Preserve life there. So that's the bishop's reading. And did it have therewith or herewith?
Neither.
Had neither. Are we looking at the right verse though? Verse 4, we're looking at verse 5. Had neither. Verse 7. Bishop said, wherefore God sent me before you to preserve you and prosper, I think. Is that the, no? To preserve you and
a posterity
in the earth. Cramer's Bible had to make provision that ye might continue in the earth. So King James says that, and God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Everything okay?
No.
Uh-oh. He had to leave. He's got a phone call and had to leave, so. All right. Everybody understand what's going on here? I mean, do we need to go through all of these, or is everybody kind of following this? I feel like we've been interrupted a few times, and everyone might be somewhat distracted. You can look at the rest of this list on your own time, but what you should be getting a sense here that is the Bishop's Bible basically following the Great Bible with very little change is the point. That's the point. So go to the bottom of page 6. Rounding out our look at the bishop's Old Testament, Mamre presents the following, presents the findings of Professor Westcott and Edie. The following screenshots are taken from page 276 and 277 of Mombert's book. So let's look at that. So that would be this right here, top page 7. In the Old Testament, the Great Bible was not only the basis of the bishops, but to a considerable extent remained unchanged. Professor Westcott has carefully examined Isaiah 53, reaches the result that of the 21 corrections, 5 are due to the Geneva version, 5 agree with Pangenius, 3 with Leo Judas. So those are other editions of the Old Testament. 3 with Castilio and 1 with Munster. 1 is simply linguistic and 3 are apparently original. So even when they're changing it, even when they're changing the Great Bible to result in the Bishop's Bible, are they coming up with their own original renderings or are they mostly getting it from other places? They're mostly getting it from other places. Okay? Great Bible, verse 3. Yea, he was despised and therefore regarded him not, omitted in the bishops. Verse 4. Taken on him are infirmity, bishops, cast down of God and punished is omitted in the bishops. Professor Eddy notices 12 changes in the first 20 verses of Genesis chapter, that'd be 37. And they contain only 2 places which possibly may be called original in a restricted sense. And then he gives them he lists them out, which we don't necessarily have to read. Then go to the next paragraph. Among 7 changes in Ezekiel 37, I cannot find 1 single original one. Among 25 changes found in Psalm 19, Professor Westcott notices 5 original ones. So the point of all that data is to say that even when they are altering the Great Bible to create the Bishop's Bible, they are not getting their information from their own original translation. They're getting it from other sources. Is everybody following that? So go to the next page, the last paragraph in the cutout. So I've given you more information here because some of this you just get into the weeds. The conclusion to be drawn from these and other examples is that one does not redound to the praise of those revisers who had in hand the Old Testament and the Apocrypha. Most of the changes introduced were derived from other versions, and they are not by any means uniformly improvements which is further aggravation. That many unquestioned improvements in those very versions are neglected by them, while their original renderings are not, as a rule, very meritorious. So, is the bishop's Old Testament that good? Doesn't sound like it, right? The consensus is that it's not it wasn't well done. And even in the places where they thought they were improving it, did they leave better readings on the table from previous work that had been done? Okay, so this is now going to become the Bible in the church. Westcott says of these last, as a general rule, they appear to be arbitrary and at variance with the exact sense of the Hebrew text. Now, that is the Westcott of Westcott and Hort fame. Obviously, we don't agree with his textual criticism theories, but that's not what he's doing here. He's just evaluating the Bishop's Bible compared to other English translations that came before it. Okay, so you look at the conclusion. The textual evidence suggests that the Old Testament text, as presented in the Bishop's Bible, was inferior to that of the Geneva Bible. This helps explain why many scholars such as Gerald Hammond viewed the Geneva as the base text for the King James Bible and not the bishops. While it is not accurate to say the King James translators did not follow Rule 1, one must acknowledge that in those places where the bishop text was altered in making the King James, the Geneva Bible was often followed, particularly in the Old Testament. So, is it true that they follow? Let me back up. Is it true that the bishop's Bible, by seemingly unanimous consent, is viewed as inferior to the Geneva?
Yes.
Okay. So, what that has done, in the absence then of knowledge of Bod 1602, that bishop's Bible in the Bodleian Library, and manuscript 98, that manuscript in Lambeth Palace that I've showed you a few weeks ago, in absence of a working knowledge of those documents, many scholars have looked at this and they've said, well, they didn't really follow, the King James translators didn't really follow Rule 1 to use the bishop's Bible because the Geneva Bible was so much better. Well, what ends up happening is this. Do the King James translators follow the bishop's Bible according to Rule 1? The answer is yes. But in many of the alterations they make, particularly in the Old Testament, are the King James translators basically restoring the Geneva Bible reading in many cases? The answer to that question is also what? Yes. So, next week then, in lesson 141, I want to look then at the bishop's New Testament. There is much more to say about the New Testament than there is the Old Testament, because there is more original work done, and the work done on the New Testament is considered to be superior to the work that was done on the Old Testament. All right. So, let's just take stock of a couple things then before we go. The bishop's Bible, according to the rules set out by Bishop Parker, was a revision of the Great Bible, the Bible accepted and read in the churches. All right. In terms of the Old Testament work in the bishop's Bible is viewed as inferior to the work that was done on the New Testament section of the bishop's Bible. In the Old Testament, many, many times, the bishop's Bible, simply, like we saw up here when we looked at the example of Jeremiah 6, they simply advance the Great Bible without any change at all. So of the 30 verses that were in Jeremiah 6, only what? Six of them have had any changes made to them. The remaining 24 are identical in the bishop's Bible as they were to the Great Bible. All right. When they make changes to the Great Bible in the bishop's Bible, very often they are following the Geneva Bible as the source of those changes, even though they are supposed to be replacing the Geneva Bible. In the places that they are making original changes to the bishop's Bible, in the places they're making original changes of the Great Bible that results in the bishop's Bible, they are often making inferior decisions and choices to what they already had in front of them in either the Great Bible or the Geneva Bible. All right? And as we will see next Sunday, their work on the New Testament is considered to be much better than what they did on the Old Testament. All right? Yeah. So, I apologize if that got a little bit disjointed there. I was not trying to make that happen. But when you look at the specifics here, I think it's important that people... What I'm trying to do here, honestly, is to show people literally how the bishop's Bible became the King James Bible, ultimately, right? The Great Bible became the bishop's Bible, the bishop's Bible became the King James Bible, and they were all then altered using all of this information, or revised using all this information. So when the King James translators sit down to do their work between 1604 and 1611, are they looking at all of this? They have the bishops in front of them as the base text. And as they're deciding whether they're going to keep a given reading, are they looking at not only all of the previous English Bibles, are they looking at the Latin Bibles? Are they looking at the Hebrew manuscripts, the Greek manuscripts? Are they looking at the French Bibles, the commentaries, looking at anything they had available to them to decide whether or not what the reading should what? Should be. Okay? Any questions? So I feel bad for those folks that wanted to tune in live, but I can't figure out why this thing's not working. So we are going to be done here a few minutes early. So I think what I'm going to do is go see if I can figure out what's going on with this in the time that we have here. So I appreciate all of your attention, and I'll see you next week. We are done a few minutes early. Ernie, would you mind hitting that same button again to end the recording for me?